Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama's first year in office ends with a stunning Republican win. Scott Brown, a little-known Massachusetts legislator, swept Ted Kennedy's Senate seat of nearly half a century out from under the Democrats' wing. Pledged to be the 41st Republican vote that stops health care reform from passing, could stop much more. It's a thunderclap on the first anniversary of Barack Obama's inauguration as President of the United States. This hour on Point, year one for President Obama and a big GOP win in the headlines. You can join the conversation. What does Scott Brown's red victory in deep blue Massachusetts say about President Obama's first year? What's the leadership you want to see on healthcare, Wall Street, energy, and more going forward? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. A month ago, very few would have guessed it. Last night, Scott Brown, GOP sort of come-from-nowhere candidate, was the big winner in his victory speech. The newly elected United States Senator said it wasn't, it suggested anyway, it wasn't Ted Kennedy's seat, it was the people's.
This Senate seat belongs to no one person, no one political party, and as I said before, and you've heard it today, and you'll hear it loud and clear, this is the people's seat!
People's seat, newly minted United States Senator Scott Brown in his big victory celebration last night. We will hear from across the political spectrum today and get some historical perspective as well. Joining me first in the studio is Monica Brady-Meyerhoff, reporter for NPR news station WBUR in Boston. She was in the thick of election results last night. Monica, welcome. What happened here?
Well, what happened was until about a week ago, the Democrats thought they had this sewn up. And I heard a lot of complaints from Democrats at Coakley headquarters last night. Frustration, anger, disappointment that they weren't proactive enough in this campaign. They didn't take his candidacy as seriously. They weren't as competitive in advertising early on. She wasn't out on the campaign trail enough. And what resulted is Scott Brown seemed to catch this wave of discontent, especially among independent voters who put him over the top. And that wave just went right over the Democratic political machine in Massachusetts.
Martha Coakley, Democrat attorney general in the state, looked as though for a long time, during the short campaign period, she would swan straight into it. What was the election? It was 53-47?
That's right. And it was just a shock that it was such a wide margin that she didn't just go down, but she kind of went down in flames, if you look at it from that perspective. Because in Massachusetts, Democrats outnumber Republicans 3-1, but there's this huge independent voter bloc. And that's who Scott Brown seemed to be speaking to, especially from what I heard talking to voters on Election Day. Mm-hmm. You know, they said that they were sick of health care. They're frustrated with Congress. They wanted Scott Brown to go to Washington and send a message to Congress, and that was slow down on health care and, listen to us. We have a voice here, too.
Where did the swing weight of the Republican candidate, now Senator Scott Brown's vote, come from?
The independents, and especially outside Boston. If you look at a map of the state, inside 495, the beltway around Boston, mm-hmm. greater Boston, all blue. Outside, all red. And then in the far west of the state, blue again. It's like a cookie cutter.
But in these exurbs, suburbs,
right.
big votes for the Republican challenger, 70%+ in some of these towns.
That's right. It was huge. And they came out big for him. And that outweighed the cities, who went for Martha Coakley. He really touched a nerve. And I think he was even surprised by the nerve he touched, because he said in his own speech last night, he knew he'd caught something when he was driving out in a western part of the state. He saw a homemade sign for him in somebody's yard, and he hadn't put it there.
Monica, what is the country going to get to know as they get to know Scott Brown? I mean, a lot of support came in from around the country, from Republicans, from Tea Party movement members elsewhere. But what kind of guy is this? What kind of politician?
Well, the Democrats will say he's a conservative Republican, and that he's been masking himself himself as a moderate in this campaign, and that Coakley let him get away with this by not challenging a lot of the assertions that he made. You know, she brought up over and over an amendment he sponsored to a bill in the Massachusetts State House that would have restricted a woman's right to emergency contraception after she'd been raped. So, honestly, the media hadn't really gone deep into who was he. He wasn't taken seriously by the Democratic Party or by more mainstream media in the last 2 weeks to really look at his policies. But what the Democrats say is we've got ourselves a conservative Republican. Interestingly, though, last night in his speech, mm-hmm. he never mentioned the word Republican. He's an independent. But we had an independent candidate, somebody else named Kennedy.
Right. We'll talk about that. Ted Kennedy's seat goes to the Republican contender, Scott Brown. He will be in the United States Senate, where the liberal lion Ted Kennedy once sat. Monica Brady Meyerhoff with WBUR in Boston. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Let's get a sense of, in his victory speech last night, a newly minted senator again, Scott Brown, saluting the late and great liberal senator Ted Kennedy, whose seat he took over in a special election last night.
Senator Ted Kennedy was a tireless worker and a big-hearted public servant, and for most of his lifetime was a force like no other in this state. The first call I made was to his wife, Vicky, and I told her that his name will always command the affection and respect by the people of Massachusetts, and I said we feel the same about her. There's no replacing a man like that, but tonight I honor the memory and I pledge to be the very best and try to be a worthy successor to the late Senator Kennedy.
The new Republican senator from Massachusetts, Scott Brown, talking there about Senator Edward Kennedy. Of course, one of his top agenda items was health care reform, that widely seen in great jeopardy, at least in its current legislative form right now. Joining us from Washington on the health care front is Julie Rovner, health policy reporter for NBR. Julie, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what does it look like it means that Scott Brown is headed to Washington? Will Democrats try and push something through before he takes his seat and becomes the 41st vote that would hold the filibuster?
Well, that's looking less likely. That was certainly considered to be one option. It's obviously going to be several days before Senator Brown, State Senator Brown, becomes U.S. Senator mm-hmm. Brown. Mm-hmm. But immediately, we saw last night, several members of both the House and Senate said maybe we should take a deep breath and not try and ram something through while acting Senator Kirk is still occupying that seat. There are many options now still for moving the health bill forward, but none of them are very appetizing. One of them, I guess what was considered the leading option, would be to have the House simply pass the Senate bill in the form in which the Senate passed it on Christmas Eve. But the House really hates that idea. There are a lot of things in the Senate bill that the House Democrats really don't like. It doesn't have a public option, a government-sponsored insurance option. The subsidies for moderate-income people are much less than they were in the House bill. It has all those favors, if you will, that Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid had mm-hmm. to put in to get some of those, last few votes in there, including what they call the Cornhusker kickback. This was the favorable Medicaid funding for the state of Nebraska mm-hmm. to get Senator Ben Nelson's vote. And, of course, Senator Nelson has since decided that maybe that was a mistake and maybe they should take that out of the final bill. But that's obviously in the bill as it passed the Senate. So there are a number of things that are in the Senate bill that the House really doesn't like and that have actually gone away so far in the negotiations between the House and the Senate. But the way it works now, the only way to get a bill to the president's desk would be for the House to pass the Senate bill in the form in which it passed the Senate. Now, there's another possibility. They could go back to Plan B, which was this budget reconciliation bill, and that mm-hmm. that's something that they can do. They would have to start over, and they wouldn't be allowed to do things that don't directly affect the budget. That's the rules of budget reconciliation. But the advantage of budget reconciliation is that it can't be filibustered in the Senate, and it would only need 51 votes, and that's still kicking around as a possibility.
It's an entirely different kind of legislative path to getting something through, but that came under a lot of criticism right off the bat for being not really the intended purpose of that path.
Well, now, budget reconciliation has been used by Democrats and Republicans over the years. It's been used for major tax cuts. It's been used for very major legislative changes. So it would not set an enormous precedent. The Children's Health Insurance Program was originally part of a budget reconciliation bill. So it has, in fact, been used to do lots and lots of major policy changes over the years. But it would be restricted. There would be a lot of things that they could not do using a budget reconciliation process. And, of course, the Republicans call it the nuclear option because, again, it would only need 51 votes and couldn't be filibustered. But the big problem, I think, facing the Democrats with that now is that they would have to start over. It would chew up valuable time. The Democrats really wanted to be finished with health care and move on to things like jobs and more focus on the general economy, which seems to be what voters are much more concerned with now. So there's an issue not just of finishing health care, but of getting on to other things. So
and what,
that's a big concern.
What about the Republican claim in the wake of this victory, Julie, that health care reform is dead? What are the odds of that?
Well, I think Democrats really, having invested so much in this now and saying that Republicans have really been, you know, misconstruing what's in this health care bill. The president is the first to say that really once this would get signed into law, that people would like what there is. And they really would rather not leave the misconceptions on the table. They'd rather get something signed into law so people could see the good that there is in this bill. And I think Democrats, if they learned anything from 1994 when there was no bill, and they got their heads handed to them, that they think that nothing would be the worst of all possible worlds. So I think there will definitely be an effort to get something. Now, the question is, will they have to scale it back and see what they can do? I think Republicans at this point are in no mood to compromise. They're giddy, you know, I think with glee that they've basically got the Democrats backed into a corner. So I don't think the Republicans are in much of a mood to compromise. So now it's a matter of what can the Democrats get with the you know, what they've been, the hand they've been dealt.
Scaling back on that front may be the phrase of the day. Julie Ropner with NPR in Washington. Thanks very much for being with us, Julie.
You're quite welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about President Barack Obama's first year in office, closing with a thunderclap. Ted Kennedy's Senate seat goes to the GOP. On January 28, 2008, the late Senator Edward M. Kennedy endorsed Barack Obama, then a presidential candidate, at a rally at American University. He spoke of high hopes for what Obama as president could accomplish.
With Barack Obama, we will close the book on the old politics of race against race, gender against gender, ethnic group against ethnic group, and straight against gay. With Barack Obama, we'll close the door on the old economics that has written off the poor and left the middle class poorer and less secure. He offers a strategy of prosperity so that America will once again lead the world. With Barack Obama, we'll break the old gridlock and finally make health care what it should be in America, a fundamental right for all, not just an expensive privilege for the few.
Senator Ted Kennedy endorsing Barack Obama nearly 2 years ago. In his victory speech last night in Boston, new or soon to be formally made, U.S. Senator Scott Brown said voters he met on the campaign trail were disillusioned with Obama's Washington.
Raising taxes, taking over our health care, and giving new rights to terrorists. Giving new rights to terrorists is the wrong agenda for our country. And what I've heard again and again on the campaign trail is that our political leaders have grown aloof from the people, they're impatient with dissent, and comfortable in making backroom deals, and we can do better.
We're looking this hour at Barack Obama's first year in office and the big Republican win last night. I want to bring in a panel now right across the spectrum, some history as well. First, for a conservative view, joining me is Byron York, chief political correspondent for the Washington Examiner, a contributor to their Beltway Confidential blog. He was in Boston last week reporting on the Senate run. He's back in Washington taking on board Scott Brown's victory. Byron York, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
What's the significance of this one election, this one outcome?
Well, I think there are two things. And the first is that combined with Republican victories in governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. These three electoral results, I think, give a sense that the public is nervous about the Obama agenda and is sending a message that it wants the Obama administration and the Democratic leadership to slow down, and that it is perfectly willing to elect people who will serve as counterweights to that agenda. They may not be ready to put Republicans in full control, but they want a counterweight to that agenda. And the second thing is, it makes passing a national health care bill much more difficult than it was yesterday, and it was not easy yesterday. Some of the options that Julie Ruffner talked about are certainly in play right now, but the fact is, a number of lawmakers in the House who voted for the health care plan are now watching very, very nervously as they take in these results, and the Senate appears to be out of the game at the moment. So it has made the politics of health care incredibly complicated at a time when Democrats would just want to get it done and get moving to something else.
And the message the GOP will take from this Massachusetts vote when it comes to their prospects for the midterm elections this fall, Byron?
The message is that the people are on their side. The polls have been showing since late summer that Americans did not approve of the health care bills that are currently on the table from the Democrats. And Democrats have said, well, you know, people just don't understand what's in these bills. And when we pass them and they find out, then they'll really like it. And Democrats have used various reasons to keep going in the face of public opposition. But the message of this is, for the Republicans, is the polls are right. Americans are opposed to these measures, and we as Republicans will not suffer by continuing to oppose those measures.
Byron York, standby in Washington. Joining me in the studio right now, Robert Kuttner, co-founder, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, author of Obama's Challenge. Bob Kuttner, welcome back to the show. What do you make of the outcome last night?
Well, I think the combination of a weak candidate and a president who
this
was...
This is Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And a president who was handed a unique historic moment for a radical break with a past that represented a failure of conservative leadership, conservative ideology, created a train wreck. And I put most of this on Obama's failure to maximize the moment that history handed him. He really needed to deliver jobs. He needed to deliver a break with Wall Street. He needed to deliver relief on mortgage foreclosures. My advice a year and a half ago was wait until you have the economy back on track to tackle health reform. Do not tackle the Mount Everest of domestic policy until you have public opinion firmly on your side. I think they wasted a tremendous amount of time. The health care bill, whether it ultimately passes, will be remembered as a grand distraction that caused Obama to take his eye off the ball. And as a consequence of this, instead of being the agent of reform and remediation, he is now in a situation where a lot of the anger in the country has turned against him. If you were to roll back the clock a year, you would say, don't do health care right off the bat. Do more to show that you're on the side of ordinary people, not in bed with Wall Street. Do more on mortgage relief. Certainly do more on jobs. And now he is in a very difficult situation of having to play catch-up. This morning's Times, interestingly, in addition to the story about Coakley and Brown, there's a story that Obama has suddenly embraced with great fervor this idea of a Financial Consumer Protection Agency.
Mm-hmm.
But Obama congenitally is really a consensus builder. He's not a populist, although there's no one to build a consensus with, given the wall-to-wall Republican opposition to what he's tried to do. It's almost as if he views populism as something that you take out of the glass case in cases of an emergency.
Only.
It's not who he is in his soul.
Has the transformative moment, opportunity passed from a progressive point of view?
Well, that's the real question. And I think right now, as we speak, there are conversations going on at the White House. Does Obama take Byron York's advice and the advice of the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal and the advice of Fox and try to do less? Or does he shift gears and act and sound more like a populist?
Let's get a historical perspective here, if we may. Bob Kuttner, Brian Newark, stand by, joining us from Stanford, California. David M. Kennedy, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian there, author of many books, including Freedom from Fear and the American Pageant. David Kennedy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom. It's good to be with you again.
We have the headlines of the day, all about a big Republican victory, but let's look at this opening year of the Obama administration first. You've looked at many presidencies. You've looked at many opening years. How do you think he's done? And should he take the blame for the shift in the count in the Senate last night?
Well, let's leave last night out of the picture just for a minute. Up until yesterday, at least, I would have said that Obama, as these things go, that Obama had had a pretty good first year. And if you lay him alongside some of the people with whom he's usually compared, let's say Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt in particular, comparisons that are often made, Obama's first year looks pretty good. Abraham Lincoln's first year, the Civil War broke out. It's pretty hard to find a more divisive and calamitous event than that. He lost the Battle of Bull Run, of course, within months of taking office, and he was making overtures to the South to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act. So his first years go, Lincoln's was pretty terrible, and yet he goes down in the history books as one of our greatest ever. Franklin Roosevelt, I would say something similar, despite all the long-standing ballyhoo and attention given to the fabled 100 days. The 100 days actually signified very little. It was 15 pieces of legislation, only two of which were still on the books a decade later. And it did not immediately turn around the Great Depression, which persisted for another 8 years. And yet Franklin Roosevelt usually goes down in the pantheon of presidents as one of the great ones, too. So it's a roundabout way of saying, I guess, that on the historical evidence, certainly the first year in office is a pretty thin evidentiary basis on which to judge the ultimate performance of the president. All of Lincoln's and Roosevelt's great lasting accomplishments, the things for which they're honored by history, came much later in their administration. The Emancipation Proclamation, the Homestead Act, Pacific Railroad Act, the Morrill Land-Grant College Act in the case of Lincoln, in case of Roosevelt, Securities and Exchange Commission, the Social Security Act, Wagner Act, banking reforms, all 1934, 1935.
So does this president then look situated to achieve that kind of long-term record, given where we stand today?
Well, I think a lot will turn on the outcome of the so-called midterm elections later this year, when we'll know what kind of congressional configuration he will face in the second half of his first term. But there's another thing I think we should remember here. I go back to something Robert Kuttner just said about Obama's failure. That way of thinking about this matter, I think, overlooks some pretty deep constitutional realities. We do not have a Westminster system, that is a parliamentary system where the executive is also the leader of the parliamentary or legislative branch. Our founders set up a different system altogether. The president is only one of essentially 536 elected officials in Washington, D.C. Article 1 of the Constitution devotes 50-some-odd paragraphs to defining the duties and responsibilities of Congress, and only 12 to defining the institution of the presidency, which is a very strong signal that the founders thought the center of government would be the Congress, not the presidency.
David Kennedy, if you'd stand by for just a moment, I want to get Bob Kuttner and Byron York on that. Let me get a couple of callers in here as well. A lot of people looking to join. Miami, Florida. Mark, you're on the air.
Thank you, sir. Listen, I'm not incredibly impressed with the president's first year, particularly with this health care bill. I viewed the health care bill as a threat in two different ways, if I may.
Two ways? What threats, Mark?
Well, the first thing is economic. I know I'm not the only person in America that looks at this health care bill, sees all the taxes that we're about to be lumped on with, and figures that I'm going to have to make a choice. And I can't cancel my food. I can't cancel my rent. But one of the few things that I may be able to cancel is my health care, which why would I? It doesn't make any sense that I would be forced by government in order to make a choice like that, cancel my health care in order to pay these taxes.
But what a lousy choice to have to make. But we can see, so you're happy with Scott Brown's opposition on the health care front, happy with the outcome. We got it, Mark. Thank you. Buffalo, New York. Russ, you're on the air, Russ.
Yeah, this is a great program, and truly many of the people have explained things to me in wonderful fashion. Love your program, too, incidentally. But a couple of things, actually. The first of which is, can you imagine, or do any of the people there have any comments on what we would be in if John McCain and Sarah Palin had won this presidential election. Good God.
Where would we be 1 year later on that front? We'll ask it. Let me get one more from the state that made the vote. Paula in Newton, Massachusetts. Paula, you're on the air.
Yes, I'm one of almost half the people in Massachusetts that voted for Martha Coakley. And I think we need to keep our eye on the ball now, which is that we need to pass the health care bill immediately. And I support, even though there are things in the Senate bill I don't like, I don't think it's up to Obama to sell it, and I think that the House should pass the Senate bill immediately and then get on to the business of jobs. I don't think we need to take any advice from any Republicans who for 9 years did absolutely nothing on health care or jobs or any of the other economic things that happened. And I just want to point out that the stock for drug companies went up majorly yesterday.
Right. They saw some running room there, maybe with the sand in the gears of health care reform's passage. Paula, thanks for calling. All right, there's a lot on the table. Bob Kuttner, to the possibility of pushing through health care reform strictly based on what the Senate passed. The House pick it up, pass it, be done even before Scott Brown arrived in Washington potentially. Do you think that could happen?
Well, they could, but I don't think they're going to. The bill passed the House only by five votes, 220 to 215. And I just don't think the votes are there to do this. Can I comment on something that Professor Kennedy said?
Yes.
The modern use of the filibuster as a 60-vote requirement to pass anything of consequence is not in the Constitution. It dates only to the late 1970s. And the Democrats ought to take this on. Second point, it is inconceivable that had a Republican run against a Democrat in January of 1934, that Republican candidate slogan would have been, elect me and I will block Roosevelt's program. Because even though the Depression was far from over, the people had the sense that Roosevelt was on their side. And I think that's Obama's biggest single failure. He has not created the sense that he's a champion of the people. This health care bill, and I would hold my nose and vote for it, is a lousy bill. It's a toxic bill. It has a mandate that coerces people to do something. It diverts money from Medicare, and it taxes the premiums of workers who happen to be lucky enough to have good health insurance. Obama handed on a platter talking points to the Republicans on why this was lousy legislation. He did this because Rahm Emanuel decided that the way to pass this bill was to get in bed with the insurance companies so that he wouldn't have Harry and Louise opposing him. It was a tactic that completely backfired. And a lot of Democratic senators, Byron Dorgan, great senator from North Dakota, he retires early because so many of the good citizens of North Dakota hate this bill. So Obama has not risen to the occasion, and it would take a miracle for him to break even in November.
Byron York, how do you see the health care debate and path playing out for the GOP in the midterm elections? Who knows what will happen with it, but either way, how do you see it playing?
Well, the reason the New Deal analogy doesn't work here is that people do not see the health care bill as a measure that will make the economy better. Obama had an enormous mandate to do something about the economy in January of 2009, and we should give him credit for helping get the country through the sense of near panic that existed in January 2009. But what he did was, after making those moves, he immediately pivoted to health care and tried to argue that passing health care reform was the only way to achieve true recovery. And nobody bought that. And the reason we've had so many Democrats talking about making a pivot to jobs in the economy is because that they realize that they're not really spending all their time right now on the public's number one priority. So they've already spent all of this time on this, and the public is becoming increasingly angry about it. Now, the question is, if they pass it now, will everybody forget by November? And they're mad about the stimulus now, and it's been quite a while, so I think the answer to that is no.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the first year of the Obama presidency, closing with a stunning Republican win as Democrats lose their filibuster-proof majority in the United States Senate. Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, is with us, author of Obama's Challenge. Byron York is here, chief political correspondent and columnist for the Washington Examiner, and Pulitzer Prize-winning American historian David Kennedy joins us from Stanford, California, author of Freedom from Fear. In her concession speech last night in Boston, the Democrat who lost, Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley, said voters she met on the campaign trail were unhappy with the state of the nation.
Anyone who's been out on the campaign trail, particularly in this race, has seen the anger of folks who are frustrated, concerned. They are angry about health care issues, and they're angry about our two wars, our inability to properly care for those who return home after fighting. I had hoped, in the best interests of our state and the country, to go to Washington to address these issues. I hope that as a nation and as a commonwealth, we can do better in the future.
In the future, maybe. And how's the first year of this presidency working out? The president himself spoke to that with Oprah Winfrey in her Christmas at the White House special in mid-December. Oprah asked the president what grade he would give himself for his first year in office.
B plus, because of the things that are undone.
Okay.
Healthcare is not yet signed. If I get healthcare passed, we tip into A minus.
Healthcare passed, tips into A minus, less likely today with the outcome of this vote. Tom in Louisville, Kentucky, you're on the air, Tom.
Hello.
Hi, what do you see?
Well, what I see, by the way, I just want to say, I went to Florida for 4 years and registered voters to see this president elected, and now I'm just absolutely frustrated, and I haven't lifted a finger for the Democratic Party in 6 months. I expect my president to wield power, and he should not take the wrong message from what happened yesterday. Another headline from yesterday is 10,000 people marched in Phoenix, Arizona for immigration reform and against racism.
Mm-hmm.
And the Democrats nor the president have even brought that issue up. And I can guarantee you, I worked in Florida during the election. They will, the Haitian and Latino voters will not show up to the polls in 2010 if they don't hear something about immigration reform or the health care. We need a public option. They need to use reconciliation. Democrats are getting very disgruntled, and we're sitting on our hands. We want to, well, why should we send our money in? Go out, go door-to-door, register voters. For what?
Tom, we've got it. We've got it pretty loud and clear. Bob Kuttner, I see you nodding your head there. I mean, there was, Tom, 4 years you spent registering Democratic voters in Florida. You got the president he worked for. Doesn't feel like he's got what the campaign for.
You know, Barack Obama was a superb candidate. He talked about the audacity of hope. We expected the same kind of leadership in him as a president. That's what distinguished Lincoln and Roosevelt and the Lyndon Johnson of the civil rights era. Presidential leadership is the game changer because it can bring public opinion along. I think that's the level where he has failed so far. He has been somewhat diffident. He's been somewhat aloof. He has not been hands-on. He has not motivated the public to demand that the Republicans stop obstructing his agenda. And let's not forget, the Republicans have been wall-to-wall obstructionist. And instead of learning from that and being more of a fighter, he has tried to be a conciliator. We wasted weeks and weeks and weeks while Harry Reid and some of the other Democratic senators looked for a few Republicans to support this
one,
health bill.
One, two. Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get any of them. But the Democrats dithered while they tried one more time to look for bipartisanship. So when the other side is determined to destroy you, that's when you need to stand up and fight. And I think Americans have been waiting for this president to be the kind of fighter that he seemed to be on the campaign trail. That's why I would not put him yet in a league with Roosevelt and Lincoln, and we'll see whether this is a wake-up call.
Well, it's early for that. In any case, I'm sure David Kennedy would agree. But Byron York, I mean, you opened your remarks here saying that the vote in Massachusetts was a message from Americans to slow down. Bob Kuttner and some of our callers are saying no, they want him to, you know, speed up, stand up, fight. Which is it?
Well, the enormous frustration that we've seen on the left, I think, is quite understandable, because they look at a president and see he's a Democrat. He was elected solidly in November 2008. You have 60 senators, Democratic senators in the House. You had, I've just forgotten the number. You had an enormous majority in the House, and you're thinking, we can't get stuff done with that. But the problem is it's hard to get really, really big things done, and this health care is something that's really, really big. Bob Cutner referred earlier very briefly to changing the rules of the filibuster. That's probably not going to happen. And if you look at the White House website, and they're happy to tell you the president's accomplishments in his first year, they'll say passing and signing a $787 billion stimulus bill. They'll say expanding the children's health insurance program. They'll say passing the Lilly Ledbetter Act. These are all things that President Obama and Democrats passed through the Congress and signed into law. It's not as if they can't get anything done. It's just very hard to get an enormous bill done in which the country is opposed to it. So it's not really a structural problem. It's a content problem with what is in the Democratic health care bills.
David Kennedy, what do you see here? Look against the pattern of history. If Obama had come in and pushed harder for the change, might he be in better political shape today or more backlash?
Well, first of all, let me say something that Byron York just mentioned. Let me emphasize it or underline it. That the president did right out of the chute, you might say, in his first weeks in office, get the stimulus bill passed. And that hardly represents inattention to the state of the economy. And I think we ought to remember he should get some credit for that. To be sure, unemployment is above 10%, as it was, incidentally, in Ronald Reagan's first year. So that there's, again, precedent for recovering from that kind of a situation. But it's not as if he paid no attention to the economy at all. I do think he was trying to capitalize on the momentum that he had coming out of the campaign, the election, by taking on this enormously difficult issue of health care reform, which has been on the national agenda in one form or another for 100 years, going back to the Theodore Roosevelt's Progressive Party platform in 1912, mind you. So I think the word failure is just a little too strong for me here in this case. For one thing, day isn't over yet. He still might get some kind of bill out of this Congress in the weeks ahead. But I do think that it's way too early on historical grounds to judge this presidency a failure or a success, for that matter.
Let's get a call from Paul in Chelmsford, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to comment basically on a few things. Basically, I think Scott Brown is a good choice. It sends a message, as everybody's been sort of stating, that the people are tired of it. And here in Massachusetts, we've seen a lot of it. Basically, as a blue state, we couldn't get anything done. And the arrogance of the Democratic legislature here is just ridiculous. The people would vote in favor of certain bills and certain laws, and they would reject it, saying, no, we know what's best for you. And if you ever heard any Barney Frank speeches, he calls his constituents stupids and idiots.
You said Barney Frank there. So the arrogance of the Democrats you're speaking to, but what about the president's efforts to get health care to more people, to pump up the economy? Count for something, nothing?
No, I don't think it's actually going to help the economy, as you guys have been stating to a point. It's going to cost people money. Another thing that I understand, what I understand from numbers, is that 85% of the people are happy with their health care coverage. I mean, why sit there if you're at a picnic and everybody's happy with the meal? Why change it around and go completely vegetarian if only a few people want vegetarian?
Well, maybe because a bunch of people are starving, but maybe not, we see now with this vote. And, Paul, thanks for your call. Ann, Wayland, Massachusetts, you're on the air, Ann.
Yes, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the results in Massachusetts, which towns went Democrat and which ones went Republican yesterday, boy, it sure looks like the country as a whole. Because the small town areas and the rural areas of Massachusetts, except for northwest Massachusetts, where Martha Coakley's from, for the most part went for Scott Brown. And, you know, it makes you wonder what and why can't the Democrats throughout the country talk to these people in small communities, small towns, rural areas, and make them understand, you know, that many of their policies will be good for them, too, and better for them, too, especially since, you know, much of the Republican policies over the years have really led to the decline of those areas with pulling out of small factory operations. And,
though a lot of suburbs and exurbs, as you say, and not buying that yesterday. Bob Cutner, what about it? It comes back to the question Democrats have wrestled with, you know, whatever happened to Kansas and, you know, why isn't this part of the country coming into the fold? What about our caller Paul's charge of arrogance in the Democratic Party? Where does that come from?
I think when a president takes office in this kind of a crisis, the president either becomes the instrument of doing something about the sources of popular rage, or the president becomes the target of that rage. And the really interesting thing in the next few weeks is going to be seeing whether Obama draws the right lessons from this. Will he start talking more like a populist, like a progressive? Will he really start understanding why people are so agitated about the high unemployment, about the mortgage foreclosures, and turn into the champion of ordinary people that we thought we were electing? Or will he take the advice of the conservatives and try to do less and be even more of a pinata for the Republicans?
What do you see in Scott Brown, Byron York? Do you see him aligning closely with the conservative Republican leadership? Is he more of an independent? Where do you see him standing once he gets on the Senate floor?
Well, certainly he's the 41st vote on this health care issue. The Scott Brown that I heard campaign was someone who was in favor of lower taxes, in favor of less regulation, in favor of a strong national defense. He was pro-choice, although with some restrictions. He was pro-Second Amendment. So my guess is he'll be mostly aligned with the conservatives and Republicans. I should say that the debate we're hearing now among the left is very similar to the debate that we've been hearing on the right after the Republican Party's much more serious defeats in 2006 and 2008 when their clock is completely cleaned. You have Republicans saying we need to be more moderate, we need to move to the center, we need to be a big tent. Other Republicans saying we need to get back to our true conservative values and double down. And that's a debate that is still going on right now. And as a matter of fact, the debate has, among the Republicans, has only sort of moved off to the side because there are so many mistakes being made by Democrats that are taking the front of the stage. But you have two similar debates going on among the two political parties right now.
David Kennedy, what about this issue of Obama when it comes to, you know, will he, should he be cool, thoughtful, or passionate and progressive? I mean, style and substance get very much tied up here. Given the point he's come to at the end on the anniversary of his first year in office, what does history tell us about what looks more effective in getting out of this kind of jam?
Well, I do think you're right, especially about the merger of style and substance. And I do think one of the deeper agendas of President Obama has been to try to recreate a more stable center ground in American political culture. That may prove to be a fatuous kind of a pursuit, but I do think that's part of his style. But, you know, I think there's something else here that both Byron York and Robert Kuttner have mentioned, so several of your callers, when we hear words like rage and arrogance. It seems to me the deeper issue here for the Democratic Party, and this is not new with last night's election results, is this sense in big parts of the citizenry and the electorate that the Democrats are elitist, that they're not listening to the popular voice, that they're not properly responding to the real felt needs of big parts of the country, not least of all in the rural and largely red states. I think that is a deep structural issue that has beset the Democratic Party for a generation. And to what else can we attribute the popularity in so many quarters of Sarah Palin, for example? And it seems to have played into this election yesterday in Massachusetts. So I think that's a real deep issue that the Democrats have to somehow take on.
Bob Kuttner, do you see that as having played a significant role in the vote yesterday in Massachusetts? And do you see a deeper structural problem with elitism for Democrats?
Well, I think the conservatives and the Republican Party have done a very good job of connecting the perception that liberals are somehow cultural elitists to the failure of Democrats to deliver enough practical benefits. You know, people forgave the Roosevelts for having enlightened views on race because the Roosevelts were actually delivering pocketbook benefits.
The jobs.
Right. But if you're not delivering the pocketbook benefits, then you're vulnerable to the charge that you're some kind of a cultural elitist. And if you're also African-American, that's a double trouble. And even though Obama has done a terrific job of quieting racial fears have not gone away entirely. I mean, Scott Brown's a white guy driving a truck.
Mm-hmm.
And anxiety about voting for women, voting for African-Americans, is it may be off stage, but it's always there in the background in America. So You only get to have rather rarefied views on tolerance and on civil liberties if you're delivering the goods on economics. If you don't deliver the goods on pocketbook issues, then you are more vulnerable on all of the cultural stuff.
So on this anniversary, what are you anticipating? What will be the sign to you that President Obama is making a turn?
If he gets serious about more aid for Main Street and less aid for Wall Street, if he gets serious about jobs, if he gets serious about relief for 8 million people who are at risk of losing their homes, that stuff is more important even than health care, because people did not understand, as your callers have said, what this health bill is going to do for them. 85% of people do have health insurance. I think they made a complete hash of this bill. And win or lose, they need to get it behind them and talk about the things that are really on people's minds.
And Byron York, we've just got a minute. What do you think determines whether this is a flash in the pan or perhaps the beginning of a real comeback for the GOP?
Well, I would address something that David Kennedy said about this feeling that Democrats are elitists and out of touch. At the Tea Party events that I've gone to over the last year, there seemed to be a lot of anger at both parties. And these people were basically conservative, but they seemed to be disgusted by the Republican leadership in Congress. And I don't think that's actually gone away. They're opposed to what Democrats are doing now because Democrats are in charge and setting the agenda. But I think there's a fair amount of unhappiness that, with both parties, that I'm not sure exactly how it's going to cut come November.
David Kennedy, that sounds like a still kind of ball up in the air here with that dissatisfaction, that ire at large.
Well, you know, a single swallow does not a summer make. We're understandably focused on this event yesterday, but there's a lot of history yet to be made here, and I think a lot will depend between now and November of this year on how the economy does.
Yeah, everybody watching. David Kennedy, historian, Pulitzer Prize winning out of Stanford, author of Freedom from Fear. It's always great to have you. Thank you for joining us on this day, Professor Kennedy.
Thank you, Tom.
And Byron York with the Washington Examiner. Thanks for being with us, Byron. We'll be watching that GOP.
Thank you, Tom.
Bob Kuttner, thanks so much for coming in.
As always, thanks.
Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.